emo songs are the big sad.
I know. I learned about emo from, you know, back when Elmer quit his job at Hot Topics and started working at the Musky Shop. It took us months to get him to stop wearing eyeliner to work.
Songs kind of suck.
Shut up, Steve. I'm trying to sell records here.
When I was a young boy, my father took me to see the Smitties to catch a Musky lunch. He said, son, when you throw up, would you grab while we fish below a dam?
Jay, I have to admit, it's getting harder to shill these songs because I know you have a gambling addiction.
Well, Steve, you know, thanks a lot. You know, it may be true that the wolves are at the door. I owe to a lot of bad people. I mean, it's not just the pond hockey betting. It's the Fantasy NASCAR League. And, I mean, let's face it, I can't stop rolling the dice down at the supper club. It's a problem. I'm addressing it. Okay, I'm trying to quit. But I need your money for just $16.95 a week for the rest of your life. This collection could be yours from Slime Life Records.
Musky 360 podcast. Jay Bird, what do you know about the Dirty South?
Anyway, what are you doing?
Hi.
Anyway, goodness gracious.
How was your day?
This cold. We actually, you know what's crazy? We were going to do the thing yesterday, and it's funny. We were actually going to get the podcast done because I had the day off. We had tornadoes over Tennessee. So Nashville got hit really hard. A couple other places got hit hard. Jay, I was up until 5 last night with thunderstorms, hail, and lightning. It was crazy.
No,
it's like it was nuts. Here it is in the middle of December, pushing towards the middle part of December, and the house is shaking. You're just like, this is crazy. So, yeah, we got all of our fall storms and like 2 storms in the last few weeks.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, oh, it was Buku Betty out there.
It sounds like it.
You know, whatever. It's I can never wrap my head around the weather. I just, ugh. I'm not even gonna go there. You can't even, if you talk about the weather now, and some people get offended. Oh, he's
don't want to hear about it. Yeah, it's bad enough everywhere.
He's a lunatic. Anyway, goodness gracious, great balls of savings, Jay. Free, you like this? Free flat rate shipping, 25 minimum purchase. That's going on at the shop right now. The pre-holiday extravaganza. I know you've been working something everybody's excited about. If you're a breathing, respirating human being and you're on the right side of the grass, how could you not be excited about the 2024 catalog? How's that coming along? That's Jay's. Jay does that every year. And
it's coming along.
It's kind of ridiculous. The reason it takes a year to get it done, Jay does it all with clip art.
And scotch tape.
Scotch tape.
You should see the bill on my scotch tape, Steve. It's terrible.
I'm telling
you. That's old school right there, baby.
It'd be a far easier process, dude, if I get you using, you know, at least Microsoft Word, if not some kind of graphical editor. But
I'm getting there. I'm self-taught. We're, catalog's just about done. So nice. Piecing it all together, got my scissors going, and, you know, we do the layout, and that thing comes out later in January.
I'm wondering, you know, we're going to have to do one here. Guys, we're my email, my text messages from people that know me blew the frick up after
about last week.
After I'm sitting here gabbing with Dr. Bob. Now, Dr. Bob's a client and a friend of mine. And if you come to the Muskie Shop Bash, he's been there a few times. And I think everyone, and super, super knowledgeable guy. But it's a person that, you know, he'll sit there and listen to me just obviously like we were doing on the last episode. I'm riffing off dumb, crazy stuff. And he's like, yeah or no. Or so that's somebody that's a sounding board for me. But there's so many questions. I said, let's get him back this week. So we're going to have a little more Dr. Bob here in a minute. Jay, however, I forgot about this. There were some previous winners. They were a griping, and they were saying, we haven't done a contest in a while.
We have not done a contest in a while.
We have
we
not.
Need to do one.
So this week's contest, the first person that can film themselves doing a handstand and peeing without getting wet wins what, Jay?
I don't like that idea.
Okay,
one
we
bit.
Should probably do what do you want
go to plan
do?
B.
Plan B. Do you how do you feel about an old fashioned possum hunt?
It's been a while since we did a possum hunt.
Let me hold on, cue the music. I have it somewhere, I think. If you don't hear the music, I couldn't find it. It's an old fashioned possum hunt. Let's do a possum hunt. Yeah, man. Let's do a possum hunt.
It find the possum embedded within the muskyshop.com website.
There you go. We're going to make you dig. You think it was a Mudvayne song, you're going to have to dig so hard. Dig! It'll be somewhere ridiculous. Some with something that you... No hints, no clues, right?
We're going to make this. Yeah. Steve, now you're making me work after the podcast again. So I'm going to have to, A, dig up my possum image on file.
I figure you had that
and
handy.
And then pick a fun thing and put it deep within the website.
It will be deep within the bowels. So if someone
was... And I say we dream up an amazing pack of cool things to give the winner the first... Not the first person. But the first random person that we pick.
Oh, no.
Because the thing is, you can't go first person. Don't worry, guys.
It's first person. It's going to be hard this time. Let's trust me. We'll talk when we're done. Let's make it ridiculous, right? This is going to be.
Okay.
So here's what I'm willing to do. Let's go over the top. This is like Stallone, right? We're going to do a ridiculously hard possum hunt. I will mail someone a prototype, one of the first Krakens.
Oh.
So, you got to find the possum. We are going to put it on there if that ain't a cool contest. Now, I will not send you your Kraken until they're released, which is going to be a matter of just a very short time. Because things that, you know, we're hoping to have them this fall, but it's going to be, I think, right after Christmas. But I think to make it
right
a ridiculous possum hunt, we'll do a prototype Kraken, collector's item. I don't know. Your call. And it'll be one that I painted myself, like you have, Jay, or one of those. I thought it'd be cool because I have some extras, but we will do an old fashion possum hunt.
Perfect.
It is going to suck, right? We're going to make it ridiculously hard.
Don't forget, there's a new Jay's Bait of the Week. So you got to put that on there, too. I sent it to you yesterday.
Yep, will be on the app. I saw that. I check my email daily, Jay.
And a new video. How about that new video? Steve, I mean.
Just watch it. Me and Jay were on the phone the other day, and we're sort of riffing on what we could do for the holidays. You know, you see the other people, Jay. People try to do videos, and it's very corny. But the boys, I got to give it to everyone involved with the Muskie Shop channel. It's like, you know, there's a lot of hacks out there trying to act in the Muskie world.
Mm-hmm.
Not us, boys. You're the Martin Scorsese. of Musky videos. I got to hand it to you.
What about Elmer? I mean, did I get a performance out of him or what? Outside
What's in
Nicole?
The box?
What's in the box?
Sorry. If you don't get that reference, Jay, I'll tell you flat out. Me and Jay were riffing. He's like, I got to do a Christmas video or something. And I was like, I'm so sick of like people. Here's my unboxing video. Here.
Your unboxing videos. Right.
I got to get here's a new package showed up from the. And it's like, what's in the box?
It's a different level.
If you don't know the reference, it's on a different plane. Get with it, folks. It's no hints. But possum hunt's coming around. Prototype cracking. What more could a young lad ask for, Jay?
No, that's it right there. You got me really excited now. This is good stuff. Oh man, we got to start off the new year with a great. Just an amazing giveaway too. Let's dream something up for just a couple weeks from now, Steve. That's our homework assignment.
I just try to start everything off with a bang. Bang. Yeah. Anyway.
You got to.
Nonetheless. All right. Well, let me get old Dr. Bob on the phone here. Woo. All right. Caller number 5. Who are you?
Dr. Bob, you're a winner.
Am I the winner?
Well, Jay, he just won a blender.
Tell him what he won.
Dr. Bob, you and your wife won an all expensive paid trip to Shoney's.
Shoney's. Wow, I haven't been to Shoney's in years. That's tremendous.
It's called dysentery, Dr. Bob. That's why you brought it to Shoney's. If you were a microbiologist, you would never even consider. Actually, you know what? A microbiologist might go to Shoney's to like acquire microbes that are undiscovered.
That could be true. I have some colleagues that I might discuss that with. Yeah.
I just cultured something from the seat of a Shoney's that can extinct the human race.
We have to keep it in the lab.
Yeah, we call it leprosy 4.0. Anyway, well, Dr. Bob, I was telling Jay before we got a hold of you, my text messages, my emails blew up, right? The common emoji from my buddies that listen to the show that texted me had the head exploding emoji. Right,
which is a combination of confusion and excitement.
No, because the show sucks so bad they want to shoot themselves. I think, but I think, but that's what
I was worried about.
I usually get that every week, like please stop. And it was just funny because we touched on so many things that I guess for you and I, when we're riffing on this stuff, seems a little commonplace, and then we sort of got down the rabbit hole of things in general. But I want to bring you back on, just kind of circle back on some of this stuff and pick your brain and discuss a little bit further, because something, let me pull this text up real quick, right? And folks, this is not carte blanche for you to text me, please, unless let me put it this way, unless we're transactional, please be lenient on me. Okay, so my good friend Ben, just listening to you and Dr. Bob, I have a dozen or so follow-up questions, but he doesn't ask them. I appreciate that.
A dozen or so? Right.
Oh, my.
Wow. Okay. This sounds like my review session from last week in school. Right.
He
brings an apple out of it.
Exactly. You understand very well, Jay.
That's how college works. That's called. You don't get apples in college, Jay. You get hot research assistants. Nonetheless, anyway, moving forward, one point he brings up, and we were talking about the projection of vibration, right? Something that I've not considered, I sort of let Dr. Bob field it. When it comes to a topwater bay, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's talking about the visual presence. But how do we ensure that topwater bay is driving sound or vibration in a downward manner?
Say that once more. I was garbled on my end.
Oh, yeah, no, Paul, he wanted to understand When it comes to topwater bait, obviously we have the profile, right? But is it something to consider that that sound is being driven, or that vibration is being driven downward into the water column?
Right.
So how would that play? What would have to happen with the physics of something in water to force that vibration down? Or is it, you know, how much force does it take to disseminate? What's your thoughts on that, just off the top of your head?
Sure. I think, well, there's a couple of different vibrations that are happening then with a topwater bait. And I think this is something that I got confused a little bit last week too, but I'll try to be real clear about it. So a topwater bait drives actually two vibrations. So there's the vibration that's on the surface of the water, which that's like creating water waves. When your boat travels along the surface, you make those ripples that make your wake.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, of course, there's the transmission of sound down into the water column, which I think is what Ben is asking about here, right?
Right.
So the difference there is going to be pretty substantial. The speed of water waves on the top is maybe something like 5 to 10 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's about how fast those water waves travel along the surface. But the water wave, or the sound waves that are transferred into the water column, are traveling at around 1,500 meters per second, which is like 3,000 miles an hour, something like
Or 96,000 bodies, correct? Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Some Bondi widths per second. I think
squared,
that's how we.
Right.
That's right.
Squared.
Right. Something like that.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think that's something that's really gonna it's gonna be affected by that speed. The attenuation is gonna be a lot less down into the water column than it is gonna be along the surface. So the range at which a muskie might perceive something coming from, you know, a vibration coming along the surface would be damped out pretty rapidly along the surface. But the range that it could experience and detect that for the sound waves that are traveling actually through the water column rather than along the surface would be quite substantially further, like hundreds of meters it could probably detect at. So I don't know if that precisely gets to his question, but that's something to definitely take into account, is that a downward projection of the vibration is going to be much more substantially ranged than the one that's along the surface.
Well, it's interesting because, just the concepts of this, of I damn near want to get a hydrophone and play with top waters and see as far as, you know, what, and I say a hydrophone, that subsurface microphone, if you will, for the uninitiated. But with that being said, if like when we're hearing that defined, say with a top raider or a fat bastard or whatever it might be, tail prop bait, where did that define? That's a lot of cupping of air,
right?
And you wonder with that, is that disseminating? Are we hearing more upward projection than downward projection?
You're hearing the sound waves that are actually traveling through the air, and right. That's how they reach our ears. I mean, yes, there is a slapping of the surface baits, you know, tail prop and stuff like that on the surface that you hear, but that slapping that's what you're hearing with your ears, the sound that's traveling through the air. Right.
And another question comes up, and it's guys, I love talking to Dr. Bob about these concepts and theorems, because it's kind of the immense rabbit hole of muskie fishing. But Ben also sort of pokes around on, you know, does sound refract, which
it absolutely does,
which is bound in something I've said forever, right?
Yes.
This being a music nerd and a studio rat for so many years. So vegetation is a dampener, just like sound dampeners in a studio.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you look at, say, a weed bed, and, you know, a milfoil weed bed seems to, you got to land it right on their head because it's dampening the vibration. You have this mass, the weed mass.
Density.
The density in the water that's eating up the vibration. Whereas you see, and this is just, again, I don't have this on good authority other than just simply it makes sense in some capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody loves broadleaf vegetation. I see a lot of muskies coming out of tobacco cabbage. Does that, are the muskies, let's say if we have the juxtaposition of one side of a bay is milfoil and the other side is tobacco cabbage, right?
Okay.
Is your, are your fishing mechanics and your casting patterns more akin to pulling a fish out of broadleaf, less dense, than are you not picking it apart to pull them out of super dense? So, like, yeah.
Well, it's two things there. I mean, the sense we talked a lot about this last week too. The fact that muskies are using two senses. They're using their eyes. They're using their visual acuity, and they're using their lateral eye to detect sound. And both of those senses are inhibited greatly by the presence of dense weeds. I mean, that vegetation is going to dampen the sound and stuff like that, which, I mean, and this is something just in my fishing experience, and I think other folks have experienced this too. Maybe this is just an explanation of it, is that if you're fishing for muskies that are in the weeds, they are in complete and utter ambush mode.
Yes.
And they're like, you probably are having to deal with getting the bait within, you know, less than a foot from their face, because the sound and the visual cues that they're using are much diminished. They're much attenuated in that area. And so when people talk about picking apart a weed bed, I mean, that makes absolute sense from a physics point of view, because they aren't going to have the range to like line up on a bait from far away.
Right.
Because they won't see it, and they probably aren't going to feel it slash hear it either. So it's just tough for them to get things at range.
It goes back to last week. I think a lot of heads were exploding when we're talking about where does a bait sub 10 visually, right?
Right.
So in a perfect world, to revisit, if you didn't listen to last week's listen, but, you know, we're in that 7-foot range with an 18-inch bait being a pounder, right? That would be about the rough estimation when a muskie can see it. So you're
right.
That is in gin clear open water. Now we add in different elements. What I've always said, and it just bodes back, and me and Bob were trying to trade in some emails or texts. We're talking about, well, this is kind of on point with some of the crap I've been spewing for years about slowing it down, get coverage in your casting. A couple of people wrote emails, and just paraphrasing, and essentially it's like, man, all that stuff was mind blowing and crazy, but how do I fish it? And for me, it's not that there's going to be some revelatory moment, right? Dr. Bob, nor myself, nor Jay is going to come down from Mount Sinai with the tablets of how to catch them every time, right?
Right.
However, when you understand the concepts, and for me, it's like musky fishing is a conceptual matter far more than it is some like physical endeavor. And and once you understand, like when we're talking weed beds, perfect example. Jay, you've been in the exact same spot. You know the lake I like that has the bar on the end? And I don't mean the sandbar. I mean the drinking bar, right?
That's where my head went. I was assuming that's what you meant.
I assume the other. I'm like, the bar on the end.
Steve doesn't fish sandbars. But I took Dr. Bob this fall to that same lake, right? And we went in the same place you scored back there, which is a circular bowl of weeds. And it took us, what, Bob, 2.5 hours to get one?
Yep.
Same scenario, Jay. We had two sticks on the boat where me, you, and Jim had three. And we scored, and we actually got lit up on a different fish and then scored. And you're going, it just brings it home all the time, that proximity effect of things, right? And so if you're wanting to know how to apply things, it's about a logical strategy of go, do I run and gun or do I pick things apart? 99.9% of the time, I'm going to pick things apart, because 99% of the time, these things are negative or neutral.
Right.
So that's the takeaway. It's not like there's going to be some epiphany moment of math, therefore I catch.
Well, the other thing you might take it to is, I mean, it is an important strategy, is like, how do you run and gun or do you pick it apart? And if you're fishing in the weeds, I would say 100% your strategy should probably be pick it apart. Mm-hmm. Just because of the perceptional thing that muskies have there, the limitations on their ability to perceive and find their prey.
Right. And
then you're saying,
but if you're from me, if you're fishing where I fish in Minnesota, where there's a notorious sand bite, it's a notorious rock bite, mm-hmm. where the cover does not limit the muskie's perceptional yes. acuity at range, well, then I'm much more likely to run and gun and burn bucktails over flats, you know, sand flats mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And that makes sense. But then when I turn around and fish the inside weed line and pitch the other way over the weeds, I put my trolling motor on 3 and yep. I'm going 0.3 miles an hour and putting casts 3 or 4 feet apart.
Which is something me and you talked about it, Bob, and I've talked in, I may have said it on the podcast, Minnesota anglers are notorious for what I call the Minnesota bomb cast. Right.
Right.
They're freaking not 9 miles off the shoreline and they launch a bait. So, you know, the reel is singing. You're eating your sandwich and then the bait lands. Right. But yep. structurally and cover wise, it makes sense. Right. So, you know, if that fish is in open water, he might be on that sand bite. Obviously, there's some fish that are like in super reeds, right? Super tight. Mm-hmm. But if you get sort of the open water, you go, it's indiscriminate in some capacity structurally. We've got a very mm-hmm. even taper. And you go, you need the distance, right? So how we approach, like you said, you might be better off. You're cast on something where the visual acuity there and the dissemination of the vibration, your cast might be able to be effective landing 10 to 15 feet apart where those fish, like you said, on the inside weed edge, man, you got to dime them. You got to put it mm-hmm. right on their forehead.
Right.
And that I think
and if you're putting baits 15 if you're putting your casts splashing 15 feet apart, notice what that is. That means on average you are never more than 7.5 feet away mm-hmm. from a muskie. That line comes in because mm-hmm. I mean just divide it in half. That's divide perfect. Half. Having them 15 feet away, that's
what you're saying
ideal.
About sound, Dr. Bob, I believe is what you're recapping here is just that within the weeds, when muskies are in weeds, that there is a diminished sound accuracy from the muskies because sound is reflected and it's dampened inside the weeds, and they have probably an accuracy issue determining where exactly it's coming from and how far away it is, correct?
I would say that would absolutely be true. And I would also say that when you have that going on, especially with, let's just say the broadleaf weeds or something like that, mm-hmm. I would guess that if you compare that to the whorls, suppose with you know that you get with milfoil, mm-hmm. you might actually be getting echoes off of the
latency,
the broadleaves, and that's going to fool the muskie into thinking that the sound is coming from a direction that it's not.
Do you
not.
Know how many times mm-hmm. I've seen fish come up on bucktails and miss in weeds? A lot. Yeah, you got a lot of you guys that have spent serious time in Canada and stuff. You'll be burning or you with speed, right?
Right.
Boom. He was 2 feet to the left and a foot behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a latency in it. And if you guys are like, what the hell are you talking about? You guys are nerds, right? That's the whole point. Take your hand and put it over your mouth and go, latency, right? There's a muffling effect, so the signal strength is not as strong. It's eaten up. And then there's dispersion, right? So every time a sound wave hits something, it's sent at different angles. But when we're saying sound being vibration.
Mm-hmm.
So just when it hits the stock, a sound wave, if you guys think of just this snake, right? Here's this undulating snake. And when this snake hits something with higher density than the surrounding medium, be it air or water, it hits and then it ricochets.
Right.
And so sound, vibration, one and the same as far as for our examples, is it's hitting broadleaf, it's hitting rock, it's hitting all this stuff. And now it's hard for them to triangulate. That's funny because you just go, whoa, they miss. Where I love it, dude, like I'm fishing right now and it's miserable cold, right? Mm-hmm. I love it when the weeds are gone. I love it because it's like, okay, my goal, like you said, 15 feet apart. If your cast land in a pattern, 15 feet apart. Therefore, it is never more than 7 feet apart from muskie. You know, my rule of thumb, the colder it is, I want them 5 feet apart, right? Or whatever it might be. The tighter cat, the worse the conditions, tighter the casting is. But you go, okay, once that kind of cover is gone, but on the other tip, I see it, and I fish not a ton, but a decent amount of timber in the South, right? That's kind of part and parcel for here, right? It's right. Amazing as a Southern angler fishing a laydown, like a full tree that's fallen down, right?
Okay.
And you'll cast to this tree, and a lot of people come in, they'll hit the inside. We call it the crotch, or Booker called it that in his book, where here's like where the tree's meeting the bank, and there's that line that's coming out, extending out towards the deeper water, right?
I picture it.
Right, you're running the parallel, and you're running the outside branches and all that stuff. It's amazing how tight you have to cast to the fish in that scenario as well, because you go, if he's on the other side of the tree, there's going to be all kinds of ricochet bouncing and visual disruption looking through a bush, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So there's something to be said there for sure.
Yeah. And any fish, I think, that is using cover of any sort, I always think of them as being in ambush mode, which means my feeling is when fish are in ambush mode like that, and this isn't physics, this is just Dr. Bob the angler.
Stay in your lane, Bob. Stay in your lane.
But I think if they're in ambush mode, they're much less likely to travel far and stalk the prey. They're more like, okay, if it comes by, I'm going to grab it. Otherwise, I'm going to lay here.
Well, I sort of touch on the book where I'm talking about like trees and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's an assumption. They're staged in a manner where they expect it to come from. Right? So. Right. If this muskie's nestled on the deepest outside branch, he might expect it to come left to right or up and down. So you sort of have to, like, you're not going to know off the rip, but you got to approach it at every angle, because it's usually, like you said, in ambush mode, they come out and they're like, whack, you know, and that's the fish you're looking for more so than anything, where if you hit them at the right angle that they're expecting it, because it's sort of, I think about it like shooting lanes, like I'm not a hunter, but you set up your tree stand, you're going to go shoot a deer, right? Oh, I took down the mighty deer. And, you know, and you know what, folks? Deer are dangerous animals, and they will kill you. it's better us than them. But you have your shooting lane because you have an expectation that deer is going to cross this shooting lane you've established. I think muskies have hunting lanes where they go, this has worked for me about 900 times. I'm going to always stage here and face this way because what I desire will come by. Right. And yeah. It might be a more open thing where you're talking like with weed edges and ambush mode. Dr. Bob is spot on because you go, it's like they have an expectation that ambush lane or that shooting lane, whatever you want to call it, where the dampening effect is not a negative for them. They know where they're going to feed. We're just ding dongs and we can't seem to get it come in the direction of bait fish. Now, how do you overcome that? Structure and understanding that can help in some capacity. It's not going to be in everything. But in the go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say the alternative to think about there too is, and it was something we touched on last week as well. I insist that muskies want their predatory advantage intact all the time. That's why they attack when they're more likely to attack
women and children
under low light conditions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They're really good at seeing in low light. Well, the same thing has got to be true when they're in ambush mode. They also want their prey not to know that they're there and to be taken unaware so that they can't escape.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to position themselves on that piece of cover such that they are not only cloaked visually, but cloaked auditorially as well, vibrationally. So they're sitting there, and even if they move a little bit, it's like that, you know, just to shift positions a little bit from here to there, maybe because of current or something like that, that their motions are going to be masked by the presence of the cover as well. Perch or the crappie or whatever it is that they're going to strike doesn't know they're there.
They're sneaky. It's funny where, you know, you talk about reading a follow, right? and seeing it, you know, from our end, and we're presenting something that's unnatural, but you go, they do the same things to a natural prey. Mm-hmm. And there's so many times in clear water or on those perfect days we can really see where you see the muskie slide out and it's just a stiff as a board, right? Mm-hmm. It flicked its tail just the tiniest bit and it slides out behind the bait, right? And
right.
It's gliding behind it and then it goes wham! Right?
Then the caudal fin comes in play and it moves at about 35 miles an hour.
Right. Where you go, oh crap, he did that.
Right.
That was purpose driven, right? It, mm-hmm. That fish has done that. And I always think with back to the shooting lens or whatever it might be, or you know, Dr. Bob and his family, they eat at Shoney's every day because they can't find anywhere else to eat. In the 80s, well, Bob won a lifetime all-you-can-eat card to Shoney's. I'm kidding.
Well, it's really all about, you know, practicing so that, you know, those microbes can't kill us.
Right, right. He is immune.
We're now immune. We've built up an immunity to those things.
Dr. Bob has COVID-73.
That's right. Exactly.
But sorry, Shoney's. Long man, the last time I had a Shoney, never mind, I can't even tell that story. But what I'm getting at jokingly is, like, you know, if I'm hungry or Dr. Bob's hungry or Jay's hungry, we go to our refrigerator. I don't go opening the drawers in my shop looking for food, right? And it's habitual. This is where I eat and this is what I do. And these fish have to have a game plan. It's caloric risk, caloric reward, right? You're not just going to run around a cornfield and go feed. Well, there's corn, but nonetheless, you're not just going to run around an open field, you know, trying to bite a rabbit's head off and eat it. You know,
right.
Maybe a fox would, but Dr. Bob might, but me and Jay are sane and we wouldn't do that. We are going to go to the refrigerator. And, right. It, you know, like you're saying, having that game plan of stealth and ambush becomes a matter of caloric risk, caloric reward in conjunction with stealth, in conjunction with being able to perceive what's going on in the water column. Another thing Ben asked, and goodness, we're just on one. I'm trying to paraphrase a lot of stuff, but Ben asked it a couple other people. How has this influenced the conversation? Because there's a couple revelatory things me and you hit, but in general, we're sort of on par with one of our bullshit sessions, right? But
right.
And I can't believe anybody would listen to that, but a lot of you did. It was crazy. Hence, he's back. But nonetheless, how does these thoughts influence your bait design? I said it a few weeks ago, and it was just the fact of the matter. Where, like, did the Titan or do the Titan Junior be an outlier? But we did, like, the Kraken doing variable weighting, right? Where mm-hmm. I've realized in some capacity, I need an exact size profile, but I need variable weighting with the same action, right? When in a perfect world, and the physics don't work, right? It just doesn't work. In a perfect world, I would have the full size, the 8-inch Titan, right? That would dive at the deep weight, but rise at the same manner, the same speed, right? It
right.
just doesn't work that way. We don't have the physical capability to make a bait. The only ways we can get a bait deeper in fishing is we need more weight or we may need a more aggressive lip, right? So you're always trading off, but like with the Kraken, I'm able to go mid, shallow, deep, or a combination or variations with the multiple weights and all this stuff. That's where I'm thinking about, because what I think we're hitting with Dr. Bob, and you're looking at with the angle sub 10s, and I think, you know, if they can see a pounder at 7 feet, they'll probably move on one post-spawn, but they're not going to eat it, right? So I need my baits to be able to hit any depth, because it becomes a certain point where you go, I have to get it really close to them, and it has to be the right size. That's it.
Right.
And I think the way I approach bait selection has changed more than the way I design lures. I think more so than anything, it's about closing the gap and what size is it generally, right? I mean, because a lot of times you'll hear this, and I'm sure you see it, Bob, in Minnesota. Jay's seen it. Well, you know, they're hitting, you know, 8-inch lures across the board. Well, we're popping them trolling depth raiders early in the middle of the day, and then we're twitching 8-inch slammers. It's not throughout the course of their movements throughout the day. It's not the perfect vibration. It's the combination of the right profile at the right depth. I don't know. I mean, does that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, it might be a range thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, well, 8 inches at this distance will be, that's the subtending 11 degree angle or mm-hmm. something like that. That's going to be like a 4 foot. That's like 4 feet range or something like that. And that might have to do, I'll just throw this out there. Mm-hmm. Does it have to do with what the angler is doing, or is it really a pattern of what the muskies are perceiving?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And I just wonder if you get stuck on a pattern where, oh, it's 8-inch baits and that's all you throw, and you're always throwing such that the baits are landing, say, 8 to 10 feet apart. Well, the furthest away you are from a muskie is actually the perfect subtended angle for them to come investigate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're like coupling your bait size with your casting, you know, your casting ranges,
yes!
It's perfect. You know, you've got it, but yep. You could probably maybe work faster with the 16-inch pounder.
Let's stop. Pause. Back it up to what you just said, because it's brilliant about the 8-inch bait and the distances. There should be a specified distance for size, class, and how we're casting them.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, as long as it's big enough, you know, it subtends a big enough angle, they're probably going to have a look.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're neutral. If they're negative, well.
Man, go home. Go to Shoney's.
Either snag them or you don't have them.
Jesus.
I'm not advocating snagging.
Dr. Bob invented the 20-aught treble hook, folks. It's just like the same.
My treble hooks stop at 8, and that's it. But that's sort of what I'm saying is that, you know, I think the size of the bait, probably you should correlate the size of your bait with the speed with which you're traveling and the spacing of your casts.
There you go.
If you do that, you're optimizing things. No guarantees on anything, but you're optimizing your chances in that situation.
Which
your
for
probabilities
me,
go up.
Absolutely. Which for me is like innately fishing with Booker or Herbeck. The guys that are really good at this do that without knowing why it works. It works. Right. They go, and we're crawling up the butthole of this thing going, well, these are the actual angles these things can see out, and the vibration and the dissemination and blah, 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 which is if we're fishing medium-sized baits and we're in open water, you know, spacing them 8 feet across would be optimum. The more dense the cover, the tighter they are. You see what I'm saying? You got to take everything into consideration where it becomes a matter of the right bait selection and running depth. And I think more importantly, the whole conversation piece, everything we've talked about for the last 2 weeks,
right,
being casting spacing, a casting strategy. And guiding, I've done this so long, where, you know, I got two guys in the front of the boat. It depends on what day of the week. A lot of times I'm running my boat backwards. A lot of people don't. People like, why is he in the front of his boat? Because I fish current all the time. So the front's the back's the front, whatever, right?
But I've been there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're like, why are we? No, we're going backwards, dude. I'm the king of driving a trolling motor in reverse, by the way, folks. I could do it in my sleep. But with pan optics the way around. But, you know, I'll end up casting behind someone and you're going, tighten your cast up, get them closer. Mine are landed 4 feet apart, 5 feet apart, whatever it is. And I'm having action and you're boom, here's one cast and they turn their entire body angle. There's casting to them, it's not that far, but you take those two, a 60-foot cast that lands in front of you. You see what I'm saying? The angle of the cast. Take a freaking, you know, take your freaking compass and go, well, how far apart were those? Those were 197 feet apart, everybody.
Right. Well, I feel like I got to give credit where it's due here to a couple of folks. The first thing was, this was maybe 2 years ago. I don't remember when you had Herbie on.
Mm-hmm.
But when he talked about, like, how he liked, you know, certain time of year, he liked fishing the weeds, and sometimes he liked fishing in the rocks and stuff like that. That's definitely one of the things that got me thinking about, well, why would he prefer this over that? And it did get me thinking about this idea of proximity and all that sort of stuff. And then the other one is, it's got to be you, Steve. It was completely... It blew my mind when I was fishing with you, and you have that underhand flip cast. That, I mean, people probably see it, and it's like,
don't tell anybody.
If you don't, sorry, but that's huge.
We call that Bassmastering, baby. You know that? Do you know what that's from? I've had a couple people ask about that cast. And actually, my buddy Josh Hackensmith said, I tried to do that cast, and I hate you. Is in text years back. Every muskie angler does one thing. They cast over their shoulder, the big heave-ho. If you remember, like, there's the muskie shop cover for the Cadillac, like 3 years ago. I'm on the front, I'm heaving a pounder, like, ah, right?
Yep.
Like, I'm launching the Turbic over the castle walls, right? That's a far less accurate cast than a flip cast, and I stole that from bass anglers. Because I fished with some professional bass anglers. You're like, okay, you just landed that Cinco like 5 inches from where you landed the last one.
Right.
And it's far more accurate. I don't know why, but it simply is. It's a matter of when you're coming over your shoulder, you're kind of dropping that thing in, that bassy cast. And if you fish overhanging branches and timber, you got to beam it under it. It's like that underhand softball pitch.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, if you're trying to perfect that cast, is get the rod behind your back and you're whipping your casting hand, right? Holding it and whipping it around. And once you sort of understand where that rod is in space, that's a line drive instead of a volleyball.
Right.
And that's the thing.
You do that right, you can pitch it under docks, which is not stupid. That's the opposite of stupid.
Well, when you see double tens go under a dock with 6 inches of clearance, you make you a believer,
Right.
But it's worthwhile, man. Everybody casts the same way. I went, I can't get under those trees. I better figure something out.
Right. I used that this fall, and I mean, it was a huge advantage when you're casting short to cover.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Your cast is like 34 feet, because that was my problem. To have boat control, I have to go like 0.6 miles an hour if there's any wind. I don't have the skills that other people have. That's like, I have a minimum speed of that. Well, the only way I can get my cast close together is if my casts aren't so darn long. Mm-hmm. I'm not so far. So if I cast 30 or 40 feet apart, they're landing 5 feet apart, and I'm happy with my saturation.
And that's the thing is, like, you know, Bob, if you don't know, folks, don't stalk him or anything, but he's in Minnesota.
I might have given that away.
Dr. Bob! No, but you guys are always dealing with big wind. You know, it's a rare day that... there's a lot of trade-offs in muskie fishing. And when it is windy, boat control and your drift speed are awful. One thing I'll say, and I've had a lot of people, not from the last podcast, but it just comes up commonly. And I usually just, I have kind of like a stock answer for it, right? You know, if you're dealing with like a bad drift on a river or a wind, what do? You spot lock. And what I find happens is if the baits are getting carried away from your center mass, so like say I make a cast, I'm squared up to the gunwale of the boat and I make my cast. If spot lock is causing my bait to come in to the left or to the right in an unnatural fashion, I don't do it. I'd rather drift the spot multiple times and get those natural drifts in. You know, you don't want to be pulling that bait left or right or, you know, I've seen it where if you're doing it, you can't. Dude, you can't work a glide bait in a big drift. You know, it's just a nasty endeavor.
Right.
So,
Dr. Bob, I got a question for you about, you know, we're just talking about wind, right? Yeah. And what's happening with sound when there's increased wind and wave activity? Is that affecting
at all the how fish are perceiving the sound of prey underwater.
I'm not sure about that. I would say that it introduces a large amount of noise into the system. The surface, if you got a lot of wave action, stuff like that, there is much more background noise.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're close to structure, if you're close to where there's shallow areas where those waves are going to be breaking or crashing on a structural element.
So that's another factor when it comes to sound, which would be a less diminished sense for them to apply in that situation when they want to feed, and sight becomes even more important, perhaps.
Right. Well, I think it's the signal to noise ratio. The noise just went up.
The noise floor,
if you want the same signal to noise ratio that they need to go, okay, that's a prey item, you're going to need the signal to be louder.
It's something, the same concept that we've talked about before. And what do you do when it's raining heavily? And my thought has always been, here is this introduction of white noise on the surface.
Yeah.
And we started talking about years ago, grind a spinnerbait low. Get it? There's a noise floor. And what Bob's saying is so true. That when the waves are smacking, I think when you're saying structure and cover, like, it's hitting rocks. It's bouncing back. There's too much, right? It's like trying to pick out a whisper in a screaming conversation. Or, you know, think of it that way. Or like chatter.
Well, it's hard to talk in a stadium and have it be a meaningful conversation while the cheers are... You know, the raucous cheers are happening.
Right. Folks, Dr. Bob's trying to tell you, he got kicked out of the Viking Stadium.
I was trying to hold a meaningful conversation
with the guy in front of me.
I didn't think that was cool, and out I went.
Right. It had 17 beers and before kickoff. Hold on. Anyway, so. You know, it's this stuff mind blowing, and I think it's so important we keep circling back to the real world applications. At the end of the day, I think we can all agree everybody's had a lot of time on the water and success fishing. It's fun, you know. I take that back. I wish I would have just recorded what we were just talking about. So I went and used the ladies' room. Right, it's 2023. I can use whatever bathroom I want.
Sure,
but Jay and Dr. Bob were talking about. The quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings, right? And the new quarterback, what was his name again? I'm an idiot. I just cracked
Dobbs.
Josh Dobbs. Josh Dobbs went to UT. He was he astrophysics or just aerospace? Aerospace.
Aerospace engineering, yeah.
And not too many.
Super sharp.
Yeah, not too many NFL quarterbacks graduate college with a 4.0 and perfect attendance and cared about their education. I'm sure there's some, but in general, right? I think Brett Favre majored in boozing, but, you know, sorry, Packers fans, but I mean, it's Brett Favre's an amazing quarterback.
Vikings fans too. We got him for a season.
You guys end up with everybody. Like when I grew up, Randy Moss,
you end up with everybody.
Right. You like Randy Moss, everybody just dies in Minnesota. But we were just talking about him off air when it came back, an interrupted conversation. They were talking about Josh Dobbs was kicking butt the first couple games when he didn't know the playbook, and now he knows the playbook and he's overthinking it. And that's a dangerous element you can bring to musky fishing. You hear all this nerd talk we're talking about. Don't psych yourself out. Use this as a logical starting point or a logic theorem to break something down, right? Because at the end of the day, I always hear it in emails. We'll talk about something heavily in last week. The email I said we would get, Dr. Bob, we got, right? Well, me and my buddy tore the a-hole out of them, and it was a bright sun dead flat calm, and there's always outliers, right? There's not a perfect curve in anything. There's always this one sample that's off there in the far right corner that just doesn't really jive, right?
Right. Yeah, and what we were talking about just a little bit ago before you left was, you know, this is the way to stack the odds in your favor. This is it's a matter of statistics. If you do like all the quote unquote right things, probably things are going to work out. But there's no guarantees, and there's no guarantees of something else, which isn't necessarily based in sound physics or
science
or something like that, is gonna work. It could totally work. Mm-hmm. And that's because muskies do musky things.
Yeah, it's that I don't know.
Uncertainty,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to say 99%, it's like 97% they adhere. And there's this outside thing where, you know, you get some client, like, stop throwing behind the boat. Hey, don't throw back there, right? There's nothing. Bam! And after 10 years of doing it, you stop saying it. You're just like, the guy wants to throw over there? Hell with it. Have fun, right?
Right.
I just, like, it's funny. People are always, like, amazed when they're on my boat. I'm just not a bitcher, right? I'm like, hey, you know, we're always going to fish off the port side, like proper fishermen, and we're going to throw at the shoreline. He's just winging her back there 100 yards a couple casts. I don't say anything. It just, okay, I've seen it work. I may have said it on the podcast, may have not. I was dialed in. I am so dialed in. You know, one of those rare moments where you're going to the boat ramp, you're like, we're catching two or three today. Every, you know, it's just, I was dialed in like crazy. And probably one of the better guide trips I've had, this guy's girlfriend's on the boat. She has not caught a bluegill, dude, right? So I give her the I don't give her the mushroom treatment, but we're starting at ground zero on casting, right?
Sure.
So spinnerbait, great place to start. Hard to mess it up. Long story short, her boyfriend, who's avid fisherman, he's up there next to me, and we're casting our brains out. And she goes, Captain Steve, I got a bite. Turn around, the rod's just gunked, right? I jump past her boyfriend, I grab that rod, kadoosh, and the game's on, right? I'm holding the foregrip, she reels it in, 51-inch fish, right? And I'm like, shit, all right, cool, take a picture, this girl doesn't want to touch it, like, get behind me, I'll hold it, right, you know? Wow, that was fun. That's her first fish, ever, fish. Like, she hasn't caught a goldfish at the state fair throwing ping pong balls. And 15 minutes later, and I hear it again, Captain Steve, I got another one. I go back, and I kid you not, it is a 52 and a half. I'll never forget it. We bumped it, right? We haven't seen. It's 30 minutes. Same thing happens. We get it. The boyfriend's mad now. He's like, we get this thing in. She reels it in, yada, yada, yada. I looked at her and said, what are you doing? Right? She said, I did what you did. I threw the bait out and they ate it. I said, show me. Well, she's in the back of the boat. The boyfriend's up front just yakking me to death, right? What do you do this? And not in a bad way. He's wanting to learn.
Right.
She's in the back. She's throwing the thing out, turned sideways, and we're dragging it over crappie cribs. So when I'm moving the trolling bait, the spinner bait's dragging the bottom, and she's just got a cast length. She hasn't turned the handle. We're just trolling, you know. She's
slow trolling a spinnerbait over the cribs is what basically happens.
Yeah, every time I move the pedal, she gets a little trolling bump, and it's just dragging, you know. And I've tried to emulate it 30 million times. Like, I literally went to the extent of putting a spinnerbait in a rod holder. Can't do it. Sure. So what I'm getting at, that's one of my outliers of, like, I was super dialed in, and that day she was just like, oh, let me do the most dingus thing possible and just drilled two super pigs.
But
you know, it's interesting. Something else people brought up, it was actually a guy that was at the bash. He said, I remember Dr. Bob got up this year because you asked him to come up and sort of touch on that break off line, he called it, as far as where muskies will come in on a follow, and there's that kind of degree of light angle where thinking they're hitting the wall. Dr. Bob, that's your concept. I'll let you sort of run with that and sort of explain where your brain was at with that thing and what you're thinking.
Oh, sure. So the thing is, so I think I mentioned this last time, I think, if a muskie wants to, you know, zoom in or see something or perceive something that's above the water surface, they must lift their chin. This is not a question. This isn't like, oh, that kind of works or kind of doesn't. They must lift their chin above the horizontal to 42 degrees. They have to be looking almost up. They can't look directly at the object, because if they did, the light will not enter their eye. It can't be done. It's a process called total internal reflection. It's a It's the way refraction works in the air to water interface. The thing is, as a muskie comes in, the closer they get, the reflection or the reflected, the most of the light that comes from you, the angler, which they might be seeing you in the background. That's what you want to avoid, is them seeing you and going, huh, I don't like the look of that. I'm going to break off.
That's a weird tree.
Yeah. Right. And it's moving. Yeah. You know, it's so
staggering back and forth.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, that's you don't want them to perceive you if at all possible. So as they get closer, the light that you're sending to them and ends up in their eye and has to get refracted to actually do that. Most of the light at long, you know, at long range is actually being reflected because it's shallow. So the image of you in the background for them is very, very dim. It's not that it's not there, but it's very so dim as to be basically imperceptible to them.
Hence,
as they get, yeah, so they can't see you basically at long range, and you can't see them either. It's mutual. Like, can you see a muskie 50 feet from the boat? No, you cannot. So
Jay said he has Indian eyes, and he can. Okay. He's got tracker's eyes.
Got it. Understood. Well, we're going to have to study that, Jay. So we've got
him special.
There's going to be a biopsy.
But anyway, so it's basically, once they get closer, though, now the angle that the light rays take from you to arrive at the muskie's eye by crossing the water surface, that light ray now, those light rays actually can more easily penetrate into the water surface instead of being reflected. So the light that's coming from you becomes brighter the closer they get to the boat. And all of a sudden, at a certain range, it's usually about 15, 20 feet, maybe about 20 feet or so, the brightness of the image that you present in the background to that bait becomes very perceivable. And that ends up usually, that's where I notice the breakoff point to be. It's like, oh, they see me. But if they're 40 feet away, like, they don't see you.
And it's funny.
Yeah, go ahead.
Today was just an odd day. We had the storms last night and all this. And so there were some, like, it was interesting because there were fish just doing goofy. I mean, I literally saw two muskies just swirling. They weren't eating. Oh. They were just like, I'm messed up, right? We're talking. Like, whoa! Yep. But two fish come up, break off at about the same distance where they're running behind the water column. And it was just funny. I sort of chortled to myself about it. There's the angle, right? That's the demarcation line of, whoa, that's weird. Where what I, to end up scoring, I had to back it off. So you go, what's Dr. Bob talking about? If they're breaking off consistently at X distance, you feel like you got two or three they've broken off, back it up. You need more time to close the deal is what the takeaway is from that. So if you guys last week were like, well, what does that mean? What do you do? That's a great indicator of back things up, right? You need a longer cast. You need that. You don't might need not need the Minnesota bomb, but you need 30 more feet. Back things off. Yeah.
Well, another option. And I think so. I think like you, I studied film on people doing figure eights, and Booker's the one.
Yeah,
right.
Booker's the one. Yeah,
I mean that is. I mean, he's like the one, and it's like the Matrix one, right? He is the one.
He is the Neo. Yes, he literally is. So, it's uncanny.
So I'm watching what he does, and I don't know if he. I don't even know if folks that are really good at figure eighting know necessarily like the physics of why they do it.
He does.
Just works.
Oh, he does.
Okay.
Oh, I believe it. We've talked about it. I'm like, what do you like sensei? Like, yeah.
Right. The wizardry of it, though, is like that magic wand they're using. They're like directing the attention of the muskie where you are not or where the boat is not. It's like bringing that bait in and then as it's coming straight in, you lower it as you come into the figure eight. So now which way is the muskie looking? If they're following the bait, they're looking underneath the boat.
He told me
and
one
then
time.
When you turn on the outside turn, you come up high. Well, now because you have to, you just run out of space. But
he's going the other way.
You always want to turn away from the boat. Now you don't care if the muskie's looking up because you're behind him.
Oh, my God.
So, and then you go deeper in the middle of the figure eight. Well, guess what their sight line's doing? It's going below you again. So like you're misdirecting the muskie the whole time. And if you're not doing that, you're just flipping a coin whether they're going to see you, because heck, they're right there.
So I said it years ago, and I'll reiterate this. And Bob just drilled it, because everybody's like, you're Steve Paul's a Joe Booker butt rider, right? Whatever. No, he is good. But
yes,
we're on the boat one time, and I do a figure eight, right? And I'm fishing with my hero since I'm six, dude, right? You don't want to screw up. And he looks at me and says, that was a really bad figure eight. And I'm gutted, right? I'm already professionally guiding. He said, you brought him right to you. He said, cock it off and lead him away.
Yep.
And I went, oh, shit. So if I've got this, at that time, 8'6", right?
Yep.
I am hamstring. He said, you're too damn tall to catch these things. So the taller you are, the further the angle's different, right?
Yep.
Cock them off. Yep. So if you misdirect, which is the perfect verbiage, and I always tell my clients, anticipate the bait's arrival with a fish behind it to the side, put it off to the side and anticipate. I don't think I did it with you, Bob, but people that are new to it always say, get that rod down and send it over here, right?
Yep.
Which is, now we have 8 feet with these 9'6" rods from your center mass. Right. The rod's over here, so you have 7 feet this way. He's looking over the boat. He sees what might be flotilla, and then you drive his head down.
Right.
He can't see it. Swish him around. I'm lefty, but now his head's going this way. He never sees you. He never sees what I think, and the concept I think of why fish will break off when they see you, right? Physically see you. If I'm a juvenile muskie, I'm worried about a couple things. Pike might eat me, this, that, other. Let's say I hit 25, 30 inches, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm a predator. And a 30-inch muskie is an apex predator, guys. I'm sorry. It is, right? In comparison to it can tag a largemouth, smallmouth, your general size. He still has to watch out for predatory birds, right? So a 30-inch muskie sunning, he could be picked off by an eagle. Shadows and weird things are bad. I think that's the only thing. They don't know what a person is, but they go, ooh, I don't like that. That's different, right? That's not what I'm used to seeing, right? So trying to divert their vision and cocking the rod off to the side and leading them in, that's so good, because you're essentially driving their head down. And that's one thing you'll hear, like, okay, here's the conversation. I've seen this. I don't know who has proliferated this of recent years, whatever. Figure eight, a topwater bait on the top. No. Drive that rod down and drag that fish's head down. Right? Keep them down and you'll convert them where we don't want them to see anything outside of the norm, because it's like, you go, does a muskie understand what you are? No, not at all. He has no concept of what a human being is. He does not perceive you as a threat. You are something. It's like, I told a guy one time, it's like, you're trying to take a bite of your cheeseburger and a ghost pops out of it. We're like, right? I mean, it's dumber than hell. But if something just kind of like pops up behind your meal, you're going, not no bueno, right? You don't want to see something that could be a threat. And so forcing them away from you and understanding that concept, where I think I've had a lot of days where we're fishing, say, a shallow raider, a shallow invader, whatever it might be, where I'll tell people, when you get in where you think of the last quarter of the cast, jam your rod in the water. You start creating depth, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes total sense to me. I mean, that's what you got to do, right? I mean, Bob?
Right. Yep, exactly. I mean, that's the way you beat the way that the light is working these, working you right into their muskie's eyes. So yeah, it's exactly right.
Absolutely. It's so funny when we said Booker's knee. Dude, I'm going to tell you, Bob nailed it. I think I've talked about it on the podcast years back. The best way to watch Booker videos sometimes is turn the sound off. I hate that, Joe. No offense. Or you're watching me, or you're watching Wagner, great angler, or you're watching any of these guys. Mute it. How fast is he turning the handle? He's got a 7-3-1. What reel does that guy say he's using? A TW. Well, he's going 1-2. Watch his hand. Bob and I talked one day, and I think you're the only person I've talked to on the boat that's ever actually done himself about, you know exactly what I'm about to say. It's ridiculous.
I think so.
Is using a metronome to determine reeling speed.
Oh, yeah.
So the top of your reel being one, right? So what's the tempo? Something that Bob brought up one time, and you can go into this. I'm just going to let it rip for a second to make people's heads hurt. Reeling speed. Remember this conversation. Reeling speed versus trolling speed. Let at it, math man.
Well, the thing that I think people might not, and this is going to be make people maybe think a little bit carefully about what their bait speeds are like. If you maintain your reeling cadence, like you are, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's how fast you're reeling. When you're reeling in, when you've got a whole bunch of line out, the spool diameter is what, maybe half what it is when you bring it to the boat. What that means is the speed with which your bait is advancing in the water is half the speed that it has when it reaches the boat. So your reeling speed varies. Let's say, you know, when you're out on the end of the cast, you're going 2.5 miles an hour or something like that. Well, that means that it's probably traveling at least 5 miles an hour next to the boat. And that's with not a particularly fast cadence.
I agree.
Ouch.
And when people are, and folks, like I talked about this with some folks, and they blew it off. They're like, well, there's no way a bucktail can be traveling in at 7 miles an hour, because when I try to troll a bucktail at 7 miles an hour, it all blows out. Well, think about what happens to your bucktail when you are burning it in with all that, you know, with all that speed. And when it's getting close to the boat, if you didn't stick the end of your rod in the water, what would happen to the bucktail at the end of your cast?
Yeah.
It would blow out. They always, they do blow out if you're burning them in.
Which is, if you're questioning that, Bob, explain. It's, let's say your reel's 40 inches a turn. How does the math work?
Right. Well, I mean, if you just have like a ratio of like, well, what's the size of the spool diameter? Well, that 40 inches per crank at at how many cranks per second will tell you how many inches per second you're drawing the bait in. It's not that hard.
Right.
If you,
we're just musky fishermen. This is very hard, Bob. A guy in Omaha just died. Okay.
But I mean, it's if you are cranking in, you know, if your cadence rate, the cadence with which you're reeling it in is, if you're doing 3 cranks per second, that's pretty fast.
All right. You're burning.
Like 1, 2, 3, you know, that's burning probably, something like that. Then how many miles an hour is 120 inches per second? I mean, it's a matter of conversion at that point. How many inches a mile, how many seconds per hour? But you can get a miles per hour out of that with about too much trouble. Heck, I could give you the formula if you want. But
it would fall on deaf ears.
But then it's just a rate of like, well, you know, how fast are you reeling in? And the calculations I come up with is you can, now this is burning, right? I mean, you can get 6.5-7 mile an hour rates of advancement of the bait when you're close. When you're further out, it's going to be maybe about half that, depending on, except if you're, you know, half spooling it, like some folks I've heard of or want to do.
Wonder why. Because we have only speed and depth control, half spool sieve, everybody. Yeah.
Right. So
I find it's funny, dude. Like my, there's a line for me, which is like 55 degrees, right? I do not fish any reel other than a 5-3-1 that's about 3/4 spooled when it's past 55 degrees. Sure. I don't need it. It with pan optics, some of the stuff, like you go, what am I willing to, molehills I'm willing to die on? And a 5-3-1 reel, a modern one, like say I think Tranks is like 5-8, but allow me a smidge of latitude, right?
Sure.
Or the old Revo Toro or the Pro Rex 5-3, whatever it might be. Completely spooled, right? Is a smidge too fast when you get to the end of that spool to really just have enough control, because at that point you're turning your hand so slow. And with pan optics, I see if I come into a figure eight too fast, right? I get down there, I'm playing swizzle sticks on a deep fish. He's like, nah, dude, too fast, right? Because they're going, I'm not going to exert the energy for 10 more feet of movement or whatever it might be, where speed becomes, you know, a major factor, because the only things we can control are speed and depth control, right? And I think it's so much easier. I've said a billion times, it's far easier to turn the handle faster than it is to turn the handle slower. You know, and a lot of guys will be like, I can't believe we're trolling 4 miles an hour. But like you said, dude, you're throwing double tens and they're moving six.
Yeah.
And people just can't wrap their heads around that, where you go, if you drop some LIDAR on your bucktail, you're reeling that thing, you know, 5.5 miles an hour, and it's high bright sun dev wetcom, and you're not getting hit, and you're shocked.
Right.
Well, they're seeing the vibe or feeling the vibration. They're not seeing the profile. They're going, forget about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I would say like a typical retrieve. I've done the calculation. A really typical retrieve speed is in the 3 to 4 mile an hour range. And I don't think anyone who trolls would be surprised at that.
No, because money trolling. Like
that's like the speed, right? I mean, So even when you're slow rolling, really, I mean, when the bait gets back to the boat, even when you're slow rolling, it's probably 2-ish, 2.5, maybe something like that. It's not going. You're almost certainly not going 1 mile an hour. You think you're slow rolling, and it's like, well, maybe way out there you were going as slow as you wanted. And that's the thing I think is, I think people are like accidentally triggering muskies.
Yeah.
Too, right? I mean, because if you're reeling in with a steady cadence, I mean, what does everyone tell you to do? If you got one coming, well, don't slow the bait down. Don't drop it back.
Mm-hmm.
Speed it up. Well, you're doing it naturally just by maintaining your cadence. It is speeding up as it comes in close.
It always is.
They accelerate. Yeah. The bait accelerates.
The bait
Before
accelerates.
You do anything with your rod, the bait is accelerating because of the way the line is coming onto the spool.
You can't. That's the funny thing. No matter what you do, you cannot stop the acceleration unless, I mean, if you go from a burn to a creepy crawl.
Yeah.
It's just not even. I'm super anal retentive. The colder the water, the worse the conditions. I'm really anal retentive about how much line's on my rod or on my reel for that very reason, which I won't say exactly how much, but there's a number and you figure it out yourself. But because the slowest, I said it years back, but the slowest trolling speed I've ever caught a muskie was 0.9, right? We're talking the coldest of cold fronts and the deadest of winters. Trolling spinner baits. We're talking tons of line out. So I'm dragging the bottom at 10 feet. And you go, boom. Right? And you go, they'll hit that. And I've done it multiple times where sometimes the slow stuff will work. Like you said, no matter what, the guy that makes the bomb cast, and that's what's interesting with the Minnesota cast, the Minnesota bomb cast, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's ever increasing in speed,
right? It's accelerating the whole time. Sometimes you imperceptibly, like you don't even notice it, you will reel slower at the end, and there's a reason for that. Because if you got those big hard pulling baits, it gets hard to pick up line at high speed. I mean, it's hard to draw those double tens in there at high speed, but.
Which is, you were talking about short cast, and I'm just talking about the physics of a spool line at this point. The shorter the cast, the more manageable the speed control is.
Right. There's not a very great difference in speed between the beginning and the end of the cast than if your cast isn't very far. Yeah.
Right. And so when you think about that spool line, You know, it, with each turn of the spool, the spool's getting bigger, therefore it's picking up more line is what we're getting at, where you're always trying to find that happy medium. We have rambled. Dr. Bob, this is not the last podcast we will do. People are probably rolling over and going, you're hurting my brain. Take this. Again, this is not the gospel from up on high, but it is to help you understand what is happening, to help you understand the mechanics of things, have a strong casting plan, all this stuff. Dr. Bob, what I want to close with is this, right? Scary astrophysics facts, right? How many years until the sun burns out and no one's alive?
Well, my son was really worried about this when he was 4 years old.
Still, you know? I'm 42, scared shitless.
I got to tell you, I think we've got about 5 or 6 billion years to go.
Okay.
So we better get to work on our solution to that problem.
Okay, fantastic. And in the grand scale of the universe, right, as this individual person on the planet, where do you fall in the spectrum of size? Explain the cosmos, if you will, and we'll leave on this.
What do you mean by the concept of size, like how big the universe is?
Yeah, just scare the shit out of everybody, please.
Okay. For light speed is about a million times faster than the speed of sound. Hmm. So a light year is a distance that, you know, that light travels in a year, which is far. The light from the opposite end of the universe would reach us now, but it would have had to have been emitted about 13.5 billion years ago, approximately. So it's a big place. We live in a big neighborhood, it turns out.
Folks, Dr. Bob said, you're nothing and you're inconsequential. Have fun and catch fish while you're here.
Exactly. Anyway, have fun out there, folks.
Have fun, Dr. Bob. You're a hoot, man. We will talk to you again soon, my friend.
Thank you much. I know it's hard to be old muskies don't care at all. How you trolling?